definition of GR is a 3+1 dimensional formulation where a particular clock is distinguished. The metric is written like this, where the 3+1 dimensional fields are a scalar, a 3-vector, and a symmetric 3x3 matrix. And the end result we're going to show today is that the Einstein-Hilbert action, when expressed in these variables rather than the G mu nu variables, looks like this. For the symmetric tensor Kij, the extrinsic curvature, has this explicit formula. And which of these actions you might use depends on what you're doing. The Einstein-Hilbert action, of course, is simpler and makes the full symmetry content of GR manifest. It's manifest under the full four-dimensional gauge symmetry. The ADM action, of course, is much messier. And it also obscures the symmetries in this 3+1 dimensional formulation. The action is still manifestly invariant under spatial reparameterizations. That is, gauge transformations whose zero component is zero. It's not obvious that there's a fourth gauge symmetry when you write the action in the ADM form. Of course, there must be, because the Einstein-Hilbert action and the ADM action are the same thing expressed in different variables. And I never actually worked it out, but it must be a calculation that must work is to write down how these fields transform under a time reparameterization, a gauge symmetry of this type. You'll get some expression for delta n, delta ni, and delta gij with epsilon 0 on the right-hand side when you just work out the Lie derivative and express it in these variables. And then I guess you can verify that the ADM action is invariant under it. But it'll be a non-obvious symmetry that mixes all of these variables. In particular, for gauge fixing, this is kind of a nuisance, since you want to, in order to use the ADM action, you still have to remove the gauge degrees of freedom. You still have to gauge fix. There will be four conditions to impose. This issue won't really arise in the case of single field inflation because of a detail of how we were doing the gauge fixing. We were using up the time reparameterization symmetry by setting delta phi equals 0, and then using up the other three gauge symmetries to set some spatial parts of the metric to 0. That'll still work conveniently in the ADM formulation. The advantage of the ADM formulation is that it writes the action in such a way that the non-dynamical degrees of freedom are manifest. The variables n and ni appear in the action with no time derivatives. There are spatial derivatives. But without time derivatives, their Euler-Lagrange equations of motion will contain no time derivatives and will let you solve for n and ni on a time slice in terms of the other fields. These six are dynamical. Of course, this six will decrease to 2 after gauge fixing. The extrinsic curvatures play the role of momentum in the ADM formulation. You could see if I take this action, treating Gij as the dynamical field, and calculate a momentum the way that you usually do in the Hamiltonian way of doing field theory. That the conjugate momentum to a Gij will be a Kij times some non-dynamical prefactors. So when the numerical relativists evolve GR on the computer, they think about it this way, where there are six dynamical Gs that are, you know, sort of like six dynamical fields, Gij, with six more fields, Kij, that play the role of momenta. That system of 12 fields would have a first order set of equations of motion. And then these quantities, when they come up, will just be, you can just solve for them in terms of the other fields. So I should also say that this is not the definition of the extrinsic curvature, or this is not a very convenient definition. It's defined in a simpler way and then is shown to be equal to this by a calculation. And that's on the problem set. Okay, so I want to try to derive this form of the ADM action. And in principle, that derivation just amounts to taking, starting here, and re-expressing the metric that goes into the square root minus g and the R4 in terms of the ADM variables, and working everything out and ending up here. So if you start that task and you have infinite patience, you'll eventually succeed. A lot of algebra tricks and intermediate results are needed along the way. So I'm going to go through, and it's a kind of a long calculation to go through in detail, so I'll probably have to skip some parts of it. But that's what I'm going to try to do today. Okay, so I want to start by, so we're going to just build up a big list of results that relate four-dimensional quantities to three-dimensional quantities. And I want to start by writing down the inverse four metric, G upper mu nu, G4 upper mu nu. So the G lower mu nu would look like this. And so I just want to invert this matrix. When I do calculations at the blackboard, I try to concentrate on the parts where there's some algebra trick that may be useful in other contexts. And I find that linear algebra tricks often don't get enough publicity. So the question of how you would invert this matrix is a linear algebra trick that I want to talk about. So there's more than one way of doing it, and every way of inverting this matrix that I can think of that's reasonably convenient, you know, is based on the fact that if I didn't have these ni and j terms, then it would of course be straightforward to invert. The goal here is to find a formula for the inverse four metric in terms of the inverse three metric. The terms that are added here have some systematic pattern. What you're adding here is a rank one matrix. So one way of doing this is to view this as a One nice way of organizing the linear algebra trick here is to view this as a factorized matrix. So I might observe that I can factor this as a product of matrices. Sorry, I skipped ahead. And this matrix factorization represents what's happening here. When I compute ds squared by contracting with this matrix, you can think of that as a step where I make some dx primes from the dx's and the dt's. That's what these matrices are doing. And then everything is diagonal after that. Or you could just check that when you multiply this out, you get this. So with that trick, that factorization, then it's straightforward to invert the matrix by when I invert a matrix product, I just get the product of the inverses in the other order. And then this guy is I'm writing slowly because my notes here are like a celebration of typos. Okay. Right. And then if I multiply everything out, get this expression. That factorization trick is, I believe, the most convenient way to invert this matrix. It's also possible to invert it using something called the Woodbury formula, which tells you if I perturb a matrix by a low rank matrix, how the inverse is perturbed. That's another linear algebra trick that doesn't get enough publicity. Okay, so here's the inverse metric written out in components. Another thing that we'll need is the determinant. The determinant of the G lower mu nu is hard to read off from the way that it's written in the first line. But once this matrix factorization is performed, then the determinant is straightforward to compute. The determinant of these matrices on the ends is 1, and the determinant of the matrix in the middle is n squared at gij 3. Or the volume factors that are going to appear in various integrals are related by this after taking minus the square root. Now in this 3+1 dimensional setup, vector field is transverse. This is some hypersurface, x0 equals constant. Is transverse if it is tangent. To constant time hypersurface. Oh. I wrote the definition in words instead of equations because I want to point out that the correct equation to write here is that the upper x upper 0 is 0. And that's not the same thing as x lower 0 being 0, because the metric has off-diagonal terms. And this is the right definition. You might wonder why the upper guy is the correct definition and not the lower guy. And if you just think about like drawing a curve in this hypersurface, so that the zero components of the curve are zero and the other guys aren't, or constant. Then the tangent vector to that curve. The point is that when I take the tangent vector of a curve, the index is naturally raised. This will come out being zero and something non-zero. If I lower the index, then I don't necessarily get a zero here. So if I'm talking about a transverse thing, then the upper zero component is zero. And the opposite occurs if I'm talking about a normal thing. So a vector is normal. If normal to the hypersurface. If y lower 0 is 0. That? Well, geometrically, a vector y is normal to the surface if its dot product with, one way of saying it is like this. The vector is normal to the surface if whenever I take a dot product of this form, I get zero, whenever x is transverse. That's the condition for normalness. Now, if I choose to leave the x index raised and use the metric to lower the y index, then I can see that if x is transverse means that the x upper 0 is 0 and the other guys could be anything. And so the way that I guarantee that this is 0 is by making y lower 0 equal to 0. So this is the correct definition, not this. And in other words, sorry, of course I meant spatial index. Sorry. I'm going to have the zeros here. With these definitions, a transverse vector and a normal vector are orthogonal to each other, as they should be. In particular, the unit normal. I want to, the correct definition of the unit normal is a normal vector I'll write down the properties that it should have, and then I'll write down its components. The dot product, its dot product with itself should be minus one because of the minus sign in the metric. And I want the vector to point this way. So I'll require that eta zero is positive. Eta upper zero, eta lower zero would be negative. Okay. So I want to write this guy down in components. Well, I know that I'll write it down with lower indices first, because I know that the spatial parts are zero. And then this guy will be determined, the coefficient that I put here, well, it should be negative by my sign convention. Eta lower zero should be negative. And then the absolute value is determined by this normalization requirement. And so to get that, I look at the inverse metric. This will be G zero zero. Eta zero, eta zero. And so because I have an n to the minus two here, then I need an n here. If I, the formula for the normal with the index raised, if I use this form for the inverse metric to raise the index, then I get the minus one minus n inverse ni. Working in the ADM formalism, to get off the ground, you just need to build up a lot of little mini identities like this. Now that I've defined the inverse normal and justified, you know, all of the little nuances and when indices are raised and lowered and what the signs are, I want to write this inverse metric in a way that will be convenient for the calculations. So if I stare at this, I can notice that this is true. These, if I take this out, then the pieces that are left are just the outer product of eta upper mu with itself. And this isn't a super useful formula that will come up in most of the calculations that I'll do today. A way of writing it, which is nice when it's a sub-expression in a larger calculation, is like this. Where this Kronecker delta with a Greek index and a Latin index is one if they're the same and zero if they're different. But this guy is understood to be a four index that goes from zero to three, and this guy a three index that goes from one to three. As an aside, this tensor, the Kronecker delta with a four index, a raised four index and a lowered three index, does transform as a tensor under spatial reparameterizations, which is, and it wouldn't with the indices reversed, with the mu downstairs and the I upstairs, that would not be true. So that covariance property maybe explains why it is in so many of these formulas. So that's a set of equations that sort of describe the geometry of this metric, how you form things like the inverse metric or its determinant, and how to describe tangent and normal vectors.
Can you explain again this tangent definition? So the surface here is x0 is constant?
That's right, that's right. That's right. So you can think of a vector with an upper index as what arises when you take the differentiate a curve. So if I have a curve in some spacetime, just meaning that each coordinate is a function of time, and then I differentiate it, then the result is naturally a vector with an upper index. If there are no metric around, say, to raise or lower the indices, then that's how it would transform.
So your equation dx mu d tau, that x is not the x that you wrote for x0 equals 0. It's a little x.
Oh, yes, that's right. Okay. Yes, thank you. Yeah, this is a little x.
It's a vector. OK.
Okay, so the extrinsic curvature, I'm going to take the definition to be, that is if a four observer takes the covariant derivative of this unit normal vector. The right-hand side, of course, is a space-time tensor. It's a four covariant derivative of a four vector. But if I just take the part of it where both of the indices are spatial, that part is defined to be the extrinsic curvature. Or if you could write it this way if you want to write it in a tensorial way that remembers that these could have been space-time indices. So to get an explicit, and we motivated this definition geometrically last time. To get an explicit formula for the extrinsic curvature, you could start by just writing the definition of the four covariant derivative in terms of the four Christoffel sum. Now, this guy is zero because a to j is always zero. With a lowered index, the spatial components are zero. And then over here, there's only one component, a to sub zero, which is non-zero. Its value was minus n. So another definition of the extrinsic curvature would be to take the ADM variable n and multiply by one of the four Christoffel symbols. In particular, this formula implies that K is symmetric matrix, something which is not totally obvious from the definition. Now, from here, you can calculate the Christoffel symbol using the standard formula. What I mean by calculate here is find some expression which relates it to the three Christoffel symbols or other. Other quantities that have three covariant definitions. So this is a one of the homework problems. And this is the result that you should get. When you write down the four Christoffel symbol in terms of derivatives of the metric, put the result in ADM variables, you can collapse the result back down into expressions that involve three Christoffel symbols. Okay. One more Christoffel symbol related thing that I want to compute. I'll use another blackboard. I wonder if I actually need this right away or if I want to reorder the. I'm going to follow the ordering in my notes, but I think a different ordering might have made a little more sense. Anyway, so a little miscellaneous formula that I'm going to work out is the expression. So the expression for a Christoffel symbol with these two indices spatial and this guy Greek, meaning it could be zero or a spatial index. In the zero case, we're going to end up with the extrinsic curvature, or rather the extrinsic curvature over n. So by the usual definition of the for Christoffel symbol, you can write this. Then the trick here is to take this factor of the inverse metric and write it in this form. Now I'm going to put let's see. So in this next step, I'm just taking these guys, the oh, yeah, okay. So I'll take this out and plug in a spatial index L over here. If I have a component of the four metric where both indices are spatial, then that's the same thing as the corresponding element of the three metric. If I look in this formula for the four metric with lowered indices, the space-space part is just the same as the three metric. So, In this step, I'm using this delta function to replace sigma by L, which lets me replace the 4-metric by the 3-metric. The remaining terms I'll just write. The remaining terms can be simplified too. But I'll just write the result as some tensor that I haven't computed yet, times eta rho, which will come out as an overall factor. And then these guys are. Now I recognize what I have here is just the usual three Christoffel symbol. So that's the result that I wanted, and it turns out that x is equal to the extrinsic curvature. If you calculate it in detail, you get the extrinsic. You end up getting the extrinsic curvature in this form. That's another way of proving this identity. I'll just omit that part. So we're going to have a bunch of formulas that relate four-dimensional objects to three-dimensional objects. And they tend to be derived by use of this formula and the first term giving you like the corresponding three-dimensional quantity, and then these extra terms giving you something that you have to compute separately. So this is an important one that we're going to end up using. So the main thing, the next thing that I need to prove is the Gauss-Kedazzi equation. Let me say that one way of proving it is by, let me write it down first. It's usually written. And one way of proving it is by a brute force calculation. It's very similar to this. This was a brute force calculation where we just started with the 4-Christoffel symbol, plugged in this magic formula for the inverse metric, and then just turned the crank and got something that involved the 3-Christoffel symbol. And analogously, you can start with, say, the 4-curvature, plug in with several iterations of this type of thing, plug everything in, and by some mechanical procedure, you'll get the 3-curvature plus correction terms involving the extrinsic curvature. That's one brute force proof. There's another way of proving it that's sort of nicer and more conceptual. What I'm going to do is defer the proof. I decided this was my least favorite part. So I'm going to defer the proof and move on to the derivation of the ADM action. And I'll come back to this at the end of the hour if there's time. There may not be time. So it's in the notes that I'll post to the wiki.
I think we actually already derived that formula in gravitational physics course or something like that.
1 minute, probably.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, okay. Oh, great. Perfect. Sorry. Did you guys cover the ADM stuff? Okay, okay.
No, we did cover extrinsic curvature.
Oh, I see, okay.
It was very speed covered, so you can.
Yes.
You can,
okay, okay.
More,
well, I sort of speed covered it too, so maybe two speed coverings equals one reasonable covering.
Actual covering.
Okay. So The next result that I'm aiming for is the ADM form of the action. So first I want to establish some like preliminary identities. Let's say they're lemmas, which turn out to come up in the derivation of the ADM action. Here's an expression which is equal to zero. Does anyone see why? I know the real-time derivation challenge is sort of unfair, but I have to do it anyway. There is one proof. By the product rule, this is true. And then the unit normal vector is normalized to have length minus 1. So when you differentiate, you get 0. The covariant derivative of a scalar is just an ordinary derivative. This will be lemma 1. Another thing that will come up is this. It's not obvious that this could be simplified into anything, but there's a way to simplify it. So first I'll write it as... You might notice that the extrinsic curvature is a covariant derivative of the unit normal. So this, the divergence of the unit normal might have something to do with extrinsic curvature. So here's one way of doing it. I do this. Which is this guy with two lowered indices is almost the extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic curvature is the space-space part. So to separate those pieces out, I'll use this magic formula for the inverse metric to write the inverse four metric this way. Then the next line, now the first piece here really is the extrinsic curvature. If I add this second line, when I define the extrinsic curvature, one way of saying it is that if I move these delta functions over, then I really do get the extrinsic curvature. And then this line is 0 by lemma 1. When I contract eta nu with this guy, I get 0, and then the extra eta mu contraction still gives 0. So that's the final answer. It's the trace of the extrinsic curvature. Okay. Here's lemma 3. Something similar where I have some covariant derivatives of the unit normal vector and everything gets contracted together to make a scalar in the end. This can be evaluated similarly by writing it as same trick, basically. Start by lowering all the indices and putting in factors of the upper four metric, mu sigma, mu rho. And from here, when I expand these out using this magic formula, then all the terms that have etas in them turn out to give 0 by lemma 1. You always end up with an eta contracted into a covariant derivative of eta. And the first term, I'm skipping some steps and just telling you how it turns out. And so you end up with only one term, which looks like this. you square the matrix K and then take the trace. Now I want to...
Did IK, JK?
Oh, yes. Thanks. Great. Thanks. Okay. I don't want to lose my magic formula, so I'll leave.
Yeah.
Erase these parts. Okay. So now the derivation of the ADM action. So the idea is similar to some of the other calculations. We're going to take the Einstein-Hilbert action and write it mu rho. Here's the Einstein-Hilbert action written with an index placement where I can apply the magic formula to the G's with upper indices and the Gauss-Kedazi equation to the R with the lower indices. And so what I'm going to do is just expand these guys out into G3's and eta etas and multiply everything out and then simplify. It helps to build up by, before I do all that, by building up some of the terms that will appear. So one type of term that's going to appear is a term with four etas. That'll be one of the terms when I expand out these G's. And this is zero just by anti-symmetry of the Riemann tensor in either mu nu or rho sigma. What's contracting it is symmetric in those indices. Another type of term that's going to come up is one with two etas and one g, and this is the hardest one to compute. So to compute this, let's see, so first I wanted to use the definition of the Riemann curvature tensor as a commutator. And my notes, I wrote it this way. Let me see if I can figure out why I did that. Okay. So I just moved the indices around by, here I was contracting nu sigma. Here I was contracting these two lowered indices with an inverse metric, and I just raised one of the indices and did the contraction with a delta function. I'm missing an eta, right? Oh, no. Okay, cool. And then I have the right index placement on the curvature tensor to write it as a commutator of covariant derivatives. Then in the next step, I'm going to do some integration by parts. In this step, I just absorb the delta function. Probably didn't really need to include this number of steps, but it's okay. This step is the integration by parts. I just integrated each term by parts.
I'm just asking how do you get to the first line? Did you forget and need
to... Oh, this should have been new. Yeah, thanks. Okay. And now I'll use the lemmas. Right, this guy, according to the lemmas, this is two factors of the trace of the extrinsic curvature, and this is the trace of the square of the extrinsic curvature. So this is the hardest step, I think. This is what I get if I have an integral with the Riemann curvature tensor, and I'm contracting the nu and the sigma with the 4 metric. Now you can also see that if I were to use the 3 metric, this should have been the square root of minus g4. I didn't write it that way everywhere. So if I were to use the 3 metric here, P3JL, it looks weird to me with two Greek indices and two Latin indices. So let me put in delta functions. Put in a delta function that turns the j into a nu and the l into a sigma. But if I were just to contract these indices with G3 instead of G4, then I would get the same thing. Because the difference between a G4 and a G3, according to the magic formula, is just two etas. And so the difference between these two expressions would be the Riemann curvature tensor contracted with four etas, which is the thing that I showed was zero in part one. I would also get the same thing if I were to instead of contracting the indices nu sigma with the four metric, if I were to contract the indices mu and rho. So I'm just switching which indices are on the G4 and which indices are on the etas. Then I also get the same thing just by the symmetry of the Riemann curvature tensor. There's a symmetry that says that if I switch these two sides, they get the same thing. Same by one, by symmetry of I guess the symmetry that I need is the permutation that I need is this permutation. Okay. So now we have all the terms that we need to expand out the took way longer than I thought it would. The Einstein-Hilbert action. So if I start with the action written this way, is the magic formula. Then when I expand this out, I'll get four terms. And the first term can be done using the Gauss-Kedazzi equation. And the first term I will just end up with. The Riemann 4 curvature with four spatial indices. So I can write that as well, I don't want to go over time. So let me just say that when you evaluate the first term using the Gauss-Kedazzi equation to get the three curvature plus some extrinsic curvature terms. And then the remaining terms where I have some etas just give more extrinsic curvature terms by these formulas. Then after skipping one or two lines of algebra, you end up with this. You get a term that looks like this square of the trace of k, and then a term with a minus sign, and then a term that looks like the trace of k squared with a plus sign. And then in the last step, I showed that the four volume factor was the three volume factor times an n. This is just R3. And these terms, I switch the order of the two terms, look like this. This is the famous ADM action. Okay. Well, that's it for today. I guess I'll, sorry for going a little over. I thought it'd be useful to show how to derive some of these things. I didn't get to the Gauss-Codazzi equation at all, but that's all right.